listen to my daddy and my Uncle Jay. Not in a creepy way.
I'm lacking eloquence. Here's the thing that I had to think with the thing about.
I wonder who the bitchy woman was.
You're a bad person.
So she slips in the back door. I am slipperier than you, and I don't cock it up.
Lady. Oh no.
You'll end up with your balls in your mouth?
Awkward. I did not see that kind.
So boring. So pedestrian.
That's okay. I like this podcast.
Okay, so are we ready?
Yeah.
Well, welcome. This is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1997 movie Contact, directed by Robert Zemeckis and starring Jodie Foster, Matthew McConaughey, and a cast of stars.
The least of which is just the bastard Tom Skerritt.
Exactly. How often is Tom Skerritt a bad guy?
Well, you mean in this movie or in general?
No, in his movie roles, how often is he the bad guy and how often is he the dad character?
See, I don't know. It's hard to balance because I, you know, my biggest memory of Tom Skerritt is of Picket Fences.
Yeah, and wasn't he a good guy in Picket Fences?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
he was.
It seems like Tom Skerritt could easily have played the role that David Morse played as Jodie Foster's dad.
And I think he could have also played Leland Palmer in Twin Peaks.
He could have, absolutely. So, this is on your list of judgment.
It is on my list of judgment. It is probably it's definitely a high, it's probably within the top five of my most favorite movies.
Oh, excellent.
This is one of my go-to movies. Like, if I ever just want to watch something to watch myself and kind of cheer myself up, which is ironic because it's not ostensibly a real cheery movie. This is one of those movies I go to, but it's a long movie.
Yeah, it's well paced though. I think it was paced just fine.
Yeah, because it's 150 minutes, so it's a long film. And I always forget going into it when I watch it how long it is, but it never seems that long to me. I never get tired of watching it, which is bizarre. But I was fortunate enough. I saw it in the theaters. I was actually visiting a friend in Los Angeles. I saw it in a movie theater on opening night. The movie theater was sold out. We didn't know anything about the movie. We were just a bunch of us were out for the night and we're like, let's go watch a movie. And we went. The experience of being in the theater was phenomenal. And so someday it would be nice to, you know, have a Blu-ray copy of this, but. That, you know, I just have a standard DVD copy and it's just fine.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't buy a lot of Blu-rays. They don't, unless they're priced the same, I don't get as much out of it as I probably could if I had a gigantic TV and a 7.1 sound system and that kind of thing.
Well, I don't buy movies anymore anyway. So, I mean, the only reason I own Contact is because it's an old movie at a time where you didn't have Netflix. Incidentally, this is not on Netflix, so you're still going to have to buy it. But
well, they'll mail it to you though. If you're one of those people that get Netflix in the mail, like I do, yeah, they'll mail it to you.
I am not.
Yeah,
I am not. But it's fine. So
although you know, it's funny because I'm assuming that they will. But yeah, actually, this is a movie that I bought. This is on
I've owned it. I mean, I owned it since it came out. So yeah.
Well, I can finally remember the first time I saw this movie. Let me wax nostalgic. It was last Thursday night, and I put it on the tablet as I was going to bed, and I was actually thoroughly impressed.
Because you'd never seen it before?
Nope.
Wow. Okay.
Because,
well, good.
Well, because in 1997, I looked at this movie, and I'm trying to recreate my thoughts at the time, but I thought, well, I like Jodie Foster. Never heard of Matthew McConaughey, as far as I know, and it was a movie about space. But it was not an action movie. And I'm sure I thought, why would I want to go see a movie about space that's long and not an action movie?
Yeah, I can already sum up your logic. Snooze fest.
Exactly. But as it turns out...
That's your phrase.
Yeah, well, this is not a snooze fest, though. I was pleasantly surprised.
The movie is very... I mean, it doesn't have very many slow moments. It's very fast paced. And even the downtime in this movie is so full of details that are feeding you the storyline that, you know, it's You have to really, I don't want to say you have to absolutely pay attention to this movie, but it will do you good to watch it more than once. And of course, I say that having seen it, you know, I've seen it, you know, probably at least 25 times.
And I'm going to let you drive the plot on this one, but I would submit, and we'll talk about it, but I would submit this is three kinds of movies. This is not like one genre of movie. This movie has three different elements that are going on all at the same time.
Okay, well, why don't you explain that, and then I can expound on the plot.
Yeah, let's hit the plot first. I'll jump off just a little bit. We start with a 12-year-old girl by the name of Ellie Arroway, who is, I guess, living with her single father dad, David Morris.
Her widowed dad.
Her widowed dad, I'm sorry. He's a widower.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah, and she's got a ham radio, and, well, yeah, I guess you could take it from here.
So the opening of the movie is the introduction of Ellie and her father, and they're kind of, their backstory and their interaction together, which is, mom died very early. You're not sure exactly what happened, but the impression is that she died probably during childbirth, which you actually find out later in the movie. But, so she and her dad are very close, and she and her dad, you know, she's very smart, and she's obviously a very kind of precocious child, and her dad's fostering that in her. And so the opening scene is just her and her radio kind of just communicating with the world around her and just kind of learning and growing.
And she's very inquisitive. And one of the things.
And relentless.
And relentless, yes. And she at one point asks her dad whether or not she thinks that someday you'll be able to talk with the ham radio to the moon or to Mars or to, aliens. And her dad says,
she said mom.
Oh, mom. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
She wanted to know if the antenna was strong enough to talk to mom, which is when the opening salvo of her dad's philosophy is, because she asks, she goes, do you think there's, is there something out there? And and his line was, basically, with all that's out there, basically it would be an awful waste of space. I'm paraphrasing it because I don't want to ruin the line, but. Which is not unfair logic, of course.
Oh no, not at all. And it's also a very sweet thing.
Right. From a cosmological standpoint, it's, odds are, with all the billions of stars and the millions of planets, that odds are that there's life somewhere, whether or not we'll know.
Speaking of cosmology and billions of stars, this is a film that was an adaptation of a Carl Sagan novel.
Right.
So this is literally billions and billions of stars, Carl Sagan himself. This is written by a scientist.
Right, and if you interestingly enough, if you've seen any of the Neil deGrasse Tyson, the
gritty reboot of Cosmos?
Right. The opening of that is very much stolen from this movie. I mean, the same kind of the music and the sweeping vistas and the, so it's kind of interesting. And of course, it may be a very big tribute to Carl Sagan, the best kind of compliment. But it was interesting because I've been watching that as well. And, I said a couple times when we've seen a couple episodes here at the house, I'm like, this is straight out of Contact.
So then, poor Ellie's father has a catastrophic medical emergency and she couldn't save him. And he dies. And then we flash forward to her as a scientist on the SETI project, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico.
Well, and there's bounce back and forth, because her father's death actually is in the middle of her jaunt at Arecibo, because she recalls his death after her and Matthew McConaughey, hump it out. So.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So... So
there's the beginning. There's the beginning where the scene with her father, and then it goes her immediately into her first foray into Arecibo, where they kind of introduce what she's doing and the other incidental people at Arecibo, which is where she then bumps into McConaughey at the little tavern general store. And then they eventually meet up at the party, after, you know, Drumlin is going to, you know, make life horrible for everybody as usual.
Yeah.
The Tom Skerritt character.
Exactly. David Drumlin is the Tom Skerritt character who is the scientific aide to the president and is also basically Jodie Foster's boss.
Right. Well, not really her boss, because she's on her own project and she has her own funding. He just happens to be over the program that happens to control funding. And so she's incidentally beholden to him. Because he can't tell her what to do, in as much as he can just take money away.
Well, exactly. And that's the first sense of conflict you get. Well, two sets of conflict. Okay. We start out in the major plot in Puerto Rico at the Arecibo Observatory, and she's working with the SETI project, and Tom Skerritt arrives, and he basically wants to defund the project, or at least her part of the project, because
it doesn't have any income value. It doesn't have any scientific discovery monetary value.
Exactly. So, and then you get basically Tom Skerritt plays the politician who strictly wants to deal with science that makes money, and you've got Jodie Foster who wants the science to basically make a gigantic improvement in humanity and in discovery, basically. But then
she's only in it for the discovery.
Yeah, she's in it for the pure science of it, for the pure discovery of it.
Pursuit of science.
Exactly. Right. So he's like the businessman, and she's the scientist discoverer. But then you have Matthew McConaughey, who swoops in as a Christian philosopher, and he ends up being the Jodie Foster to her Tom Skerritt. She's a pure scientist, is not interested in religion, and he is a philosopher and a Christian. So there's sets up a tension there.
Yeah, he's strongly a theologian.
Yes. And he plays Matthew McConaughey.
He is Matthew McConaughey.
No, I know, but he also plays Matthew McConaughey. No, but he also plays Matthew McConaughey.
Oh, does he?
Well, don't you think? Doesn't Matthew McConaughey mostly play Matthew McConaughey?
Well, I don't know. He didn't look like he smelled bad or was high in pot, so I don't know.
But you could see him taking off his shirt and playing the bongos. Don't you think?
I suppose.
Yeah. And
but really, with him, when can't you see that?
Well, that's exactly. And granted, that's not really fair to Mr. McConaughey, because he's played a variety of roles. And most recently, of course, he won an Academy Award and is also probably going to win an Emmy for True Detective as well.
Well, he was super pouty crybaby in this movie, though, I thought.
He was
all puffy and like, it was all emotive. And not that that's a bad thing. I'm just saying, you know, his role in this movie was largely very much like, you know, I just expected him to start crying at any moment in time.
Well, he just feels he's disappointed in Jodie Foster.
Well, yeah, he wants her to come to his side.
Well, he would like her to, I don't know, call the day after they have sex together.
How about the role reversal there, where, you know, she's the disinterested, leave me your number, and he's the pursuing.
That's true. That's true. That's a very strong female role.
Yeah. So, kind of a shattering of gender roles, if you will.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, so you've got this conflict where Tom Skerritt ends up being the bad guy in the beginning, at least, and Matthew McConaughey is the love interest.
Right.
And you've got William... Fitner as Kent Clark, the blind SETI scientist who assists Jodie Foster's character, and he does excellent work.
Well, I have some problems with his character, but we can go into that. So basically what happens is then, you know, they're at a party and Drummond says we're pulling the plug, and Jodie Foster humps it out with Matthew McConaughey. She has the flashback of death of dad and that whole, after discussing with him about how she got her start in philosophy and astronomy and all that was from her dad, the foundation of her dad. And then so she and Kent decide that they're going to go put an ad hoc SETI program together in New Mexico at the very large array in New Mexico. And so she basically goes out to beg for money because they've already procured the ability to use the large array, but now that they've procured the ability to use it, they have to get money because that's what it comes down to again. And so she goes begging and begging and begging, and she ends up at Haddon Industries, where she has her little rant and her little nervous breakdown in front of all of them, which escalates into her getting funded by the Haddon.
And S.R. Haddon is played by John Hurt, and he's the eccentric billionaire.
Yeah, and what a creepy, I mean, good for him, but what a creepy, he just played this creepy, and he was good, don't get me wrong. I think he was fantastic, but what a creepy, just creepy character.
And that works to great effect later in the story. But yeah, he's a weirdo. He is Howard Hughes, sort of. I mean, he's not the OCD as Howard Hughes, although a little bit. He's dying of cancer, and when you first meet him, he is pretty much exclusively flying on planes. And later, he ends up on the Russian Mir space station, so he never touches ground. Part of his eccentricity.
Not often.
Yeah, part of his eccentricity. Right. And I think a little nod to Howard Hughes.
I think that's probably very much true.
Yeah.
So as you're progressing through her getting funding, and they end up back at the very large array, and they're kind of whittling out their time, which they spend another couple, 3-4 years. You know, so this movie goes forward in time very rapidly, even though, you know, it's very distilled in certain time pockets. But, you know, time progresses, even though the characters don't see their story progress. So the 4 years later, they end up at the very large array, and lo and behold, you know, Drumlin and other people have drummed up enough anti-Ellie sentiment that they're going to probably take away her ability to use the very large array. And so they basically, you know, Kent says, well, we have about, you know, there's only about 3 months before the paperwork goes through, and then we're out. Which kind of escalates the tension, so they have to find something. And lo and behold, miraculously, miracle of miracles, they discover something.
They get a signal.
And then comes they get this great signal from outer space, and then there's some good science interpretation about how they, you know, they get the signal and verify the signal and, you know, figure out that it's all prime numbers. It's a pattern from, you know, outer space, and that escalates some tension and, of course, brings back, you know, everybody back into the fold, as it were.
And adds another character, because all of a sudden the National Security Advisor shows up, because this is a matter of national security, obviously, and that is the terrific James Woods.
Yes.
And I'm sorry.
He plays a good bastard.
Yeah, I like James Woods and all these sort of characters, all these sort of roles, rather. So, you know, what I think is actually a brilliant little plot point, you start off with these prime numbers and other little things that would indicate that this is an intentional message being sent. And then you wind up finding out that there's a video element to this. And what is the video element?
Hitler.
Which is hysterical.
Which is the greatest line in the whole movie, by the way, by the female, Angela Bassett.
Oh, the White House Chief of Staff.
Yeah, so she, you know, how many, I forget the entire line, but basically, you know, how many billions of people died defeating that asshole, and he's our first ambassador to outer space.
Yeah, it's awesome.
To me, that's one of the singularly best lines. It's the best one-liners of the whole movie. Because there's some good, pretty zingers in the whole movie, but that one was, I think, is the best example. And I like Angela Bassett, and I like her character very much, because she's very much, you don't want to make her mad at you.
Exactly. And it's a small role, but she is not a small actress.
She's like Leo McGarry and CJ Craig, like, merged together on speed.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit, yeah. Again, you are more into the West Wing world than I.
No, I understandably, I am the biggest West Wing fan. But I'll put asterisks, season 4 and 5 and most of 6 don't count.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I don't know if you're only the biggest fan, asterisk, because unfortunately our grandmother has passed. But she was up there as
That's
a big
true.
West Wing fan.
That's true.
So once we get over the fact that it's Adolf Hitler staring us in the face, Then they discover that this is actually a transmission from a specific place, from the Vega star, 25 light years away.
Who incidentally just happens to be sending us a signal back that had been sent 25 years ago, and so it's not a big deal that it's Hitler because they wouldn't have understood it. They just are kind of this is their way of saying, hi, we're sending back something you're sending to us. So now ball's in your court. And this is where I have a little bit of problem with the Kent character.
Okay.
Because not only is he able to, because they bring him back and he can hear things and he's, you know, there's more on here than just what you're hearing the signal. It's video. And then there's more on there than video. It's in German. And oh, lo and behold, not only is he blind, he can hear special things. He also happens to speak German.
Well, he's a magical blind person.
It just seems like, wow, he's Superman.
He is.
And then he can hear, you know, and then later on, he gets to hear, there's structure here, there's more here than what we thought. So it just seems like if he hadn't have been there, like none of this would have happened. Because he's the gatekeeper, if you will.
Yeah. And you kind of wonder about the whole SETI project as far as, you know, once you hear something, you know, I mean, are there people that are actually just sitting around listening? No, obviously not. But it seems like a very solitary, almost like a monastic existence.
Well, once you discover something, wouldn't you have every possible scientist in the world listening at that point?
Oh, well, and that's kind of what they allude to happens. All of a sudden, it goes well out of Jodie Foster's hands and also Kent right. Clark's hands. It is now a worldwide thing.
Yeah, which then leads to the big dissension of that whole cadre of crazy people, as happens in real life when something kooky happens. There's just this massive onslaught of people that take up in New Mexico with that whole vegan possibility.
Well, and this is where the movie changes into two different things at once for me. It starts out as basically like a science thriller, and then it turns into like a social commentary movie, because throughout this movie, there's lots of social commentary. And for the most part, I think they get it pretty right as far as what might actually happen if it was announced that we had received a signal from extraterrestrial life.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Although I have to make the point that, I didn't know that that one of the guys from Nelson would be the evil doer in this movie.
And when I first saw him, I'm like, that's a Busey. I don't know which Busey that is, but that is a Busey.
So you're better than me, because I didn't know it was a Busey, but I looked at it and I thought, boy, he is batshit crazy, and they sure cast the right guy in this role.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
So I didn't know he was a Busey. I've since discovered he was, but again, my first thought was, they got Nelson to play a bad guy?
Yeah, that's Jake Busey. He plays a religious fundamentalist.
Yeah, and convincingly so, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, how about Rob Lowe?
Yeah.
Rob Lowe.
Kind of a contrary role.
Rob Lowe basically plays Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition.
Yeah, I know. It's quite the opposite for him, because he's such a, Richard Rank.
Yes.
So he is the fundy, if you will, which is opposite of Rob Lowe in real life and opposite of him, on the West Wing, where he's a bleeding liberal.
And you get a sense that he's probably enjoying the heck out of this role.
Absolutely, because he gets to kind of unleash his inner Republican.
Well, and this is a very politics-heavy movie in the fact that they use real newsmen? real lawmen. They use real news anchors and real politicians, including Bill Clinton.
Yeah, and I had a hard time. I wasn't sure how much of that was just CGI and editing, or if they actually, I can't imagine they actually got Clinton to do anything.
Nope, actually none of it was CGI, and none of it was on purpose, none of it was Clinton actually doing anything for the movie. It was all editing.
It was just clipped and stolen.
Exactly, and they were telling.
And good job, I mean.
Oh, they did an excellent job.
Considering it was 1997, considering it was 97, it's pretty convincing for 97. Today, it would be a little difficult, because you can kind of see some of it, but,
the only thing that they don't get as far as what you can see through is that in a couple of cases, he's not actually saying what he is saying on the actual video, but in a lot of cases, he is. The thing where he talks about finding life, that kind of thing. and dealing only with the scientific discovery of it at first, and then we can wrap our heads around the rest of it. That's actually all taken. That's just a clip from an actual speech he gave about some sort of meteorite they found from Mars that had some sort of fossil record on it.
Nice.
Yeah. So they did a nice job.
It was very well done, but it also easily dates the movie.
Exactly.
So that's my problem with it. It's difficult when you put real life people into movies like that. It very easily dates the movie.
Yeah.
Because I think one of the CNN casters has been killed since the movie was made, and so you and I have talked before about my love of the CNN headline news, because Bobby Bautista was on there, of course.
Well, and Bernard Shaw was on there.
But one of the and I've forgotten his name.
Like a war correspondent or something?
No, I think he was the guy who was on camera when the so spoiler alert, of course. I think he was on camera when the machine blew up. And I want to say his name was Jay something.
And he has since died in real life?
It was kind of sad. He was, bring everybody down. I think he was killed in a car accident. It was just kind of one of those random things. It was very sad and very sudden, and he was beloved at CNN, and it was one of those, it was one of those traumatic things for everybody involved. But it was just weird to see him, because I'm pretty sure it was him, and now, of course, I can't for the life of me.
We can put it back in post. So,
although I have to admit, I still hate Jay Leno. So,
okay, certainly you're right. He can take it right in the chin. Why do I even try? It's like I can't. I should stop. I should not be able, but I can't. I can't help myself. Sorry. He's a better comedian than I am, at least. And actually, you know what? Sticking up for Jay Leno a little bit, I think his book, Leading with My Chin, is actually a very enjoyable read. And he tells some funny stories about being a young comedian.
I'll take that in advisement.
Okay. I'm not suggesting you go out and buy it. I'm not even sure if it's available on Audible. But, yeah, I do remember it being very, very entertaining. Okay, so back to Hitler.
By the way, Adolf Hitler is credited in this, well, uncredited in this movie, but IMDb is sometimes so fickle.
It's crazy. Okay, so after Hitler, you actually find out that not only is there basically proof that they know who we are, blah, 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 but also there's instructions. They basically give us a schematic on how to build a machine, and it actually is the Haddon Corporation, or Haddon himself, that actually makes the decodes what the because it's a worldwide chase to decode what the message is, and Haddon's
well,
the one
Kent,
that
yeah because Kent basically discovers that there's more structure there, and that there's a bunch of data that they can't figure out, and they know that it's data, but they can't decode it because they can't figure out how it all goes together. And so that's where, again, Jodie Foster gets screwed by David Drumlin, by the Skerritt character, where he takes over again, and they try and figure out what's going on. And then Haddon comes in and says, you've been kind of removed from this, but I'm going to get you back in the game, because guess what? I've figured out how to decode this. Which then then Ellie gets to go back and kind of give the brief of the primer and how to decode it, which they start decoding the fact that it is indeed a blueprint for a big machine. A machine they don't quite know the purpose of, but they kind of figure it out that it's basically a machine to get you to go somewhere else, hopefully.
To transport one person through space in some manner that they don't even know what the manner is. They just think it's a way to get to Vega. Ellie's dealt back into the game. Once they discover it's a blueprint to build a machine, then it's a race to build a machine. And the machine is going to take upwards of $1 trillion to build. So you get a little bit of politics on how they get the funding to build it and who gives up what. And then they have, I guess, tryouts to see who's going to be the occupant, who's going to go through this machine.
Right. They decide that once they decide that they're going to build the machine, which becomes this multinational effort, and there's positioning to either get contracts to be able to make parts and technology, or some countries forego that, you know, because they would rather have a seat. So Americans, of course, get more seats disproportionate than everybody else as usual because we screw everybody out of everything. And of course, Drumlin decides he's not going to be on the committee anymore. He's going to resign because he wants to go.
Exactly. So now he screws Ellie for the third time. And this is where they end up having these tryouts and this congressional hearings, or I guess it's not congressional, it's a multinational hearing, where they discuss everybody's qualifications. They want to send some want to send a poet, some want to send a musician, some want to send a pure scientist. So they go through all these people's dossiers, and they basically it basically comes down to, I guess, what an astronaut who pulls out, or some sort of military person that pulls out, and then Drumlin and Arroway, and then that all comes down to when on the selection committee is our buddy Matthew McConaughey, and he basically asks whether Ellie believes in God. And she says,
I'm a scientist, I believe in evidence, and I don't believe there's any evidence, and thanks for screwing me again.
Yes. And of course, Drumlin comes up with the perfect answer about how not only does he believe in God, but he believes that Jesus will be his co-pilot on this trip, and, well, not quite, but close.
Well, I think in some ways he thought of himself as God anyway, because he certainly thought he was perfect in this movie.
He does a good job as his character.
Yeah, no, I think I hated him from the beginning of the movie all the way to the end.
Of course, as you're supposed to.
Wow. Well, maybe not the end.
Well, we're getting there. So yeah. They build this gigantic machine. And this is where the movie gets a little bit dated, too, just because the CGI isn't quite as good as it is today. But they build this gigantic machine. And they use a lot of photos of people gathering for, like, space shuttle launches. Which, by the way, now you couldn't pull off.
Yeah, you just shut up and squint your eye and pretend.
No, it's fine. Yeah, it's not a problem. And now you couldn't even pull that off because now we don't have space shuttle launches. Well, you're not going to have people camping out for a space shuttle launch because they don't exist.
Unfortunately true.
It's sad. Yeah. And what with Crimea, we may not even have a way to get to the space station because Russia's like, no, yet. Okay. So
you get to see the machine in it. They're running a test. Because they want to run a test, of course, because, you know, we're superly cautious because we don't want some big machine that we've never used before to, you know, basically destroy the planet. Because wouldn't that be the ultimate joke from the aliens? Ha ha!
Although, I have a question about that, but we'll get there presently. But yeah, they start this machine, and they have basically a dummy sitting in the chair instead of a human. And is there an intention to actually drop the whole ball into the machine with the dummy in it?
I don't think that was their intent. I think that they were going to go up to that point and abort. I think the intent was just to do a full systems check.
Okay, yeah. Because that makes sense. Because they have to get the machine up to speed and up to power, and they haven't done this before. Now is the first time.
Right. I think it was they wanted to do a trial run as much as they could because, you know, the theory was that once they did this, they weren't sure that they'd ever be able to do it again. And so they were going to take it up to the precipice and then just kind of shut it down.
And the science, or the mechanics, actually, behind this whole machine, is that there are these three gigantic spinning rings in kind of a globe pattern that are spinning in all axes. And then there is a ball at the top that is all sealed with the human inside, and the ball drops into the center of this spinning set of rings. And at that point,
rings are at full speed.
Yeah. And at that point, that's when this whatever happens that the machine is designed to do. They just don't happen to know what that is going to be. So
right. Nobody knows what – nobody understands or comprehends because nobody's engineering enough minded to know this alien technology to know exactly what will happen.
Yeah. And so theoretically, this carny ride could end with all these rings spinning. They drop this big metal ball. The metal ball goes right through the whole thing, lands in a net at the bottom, and splash, boom, we're done. There you go. There's your $1 trillion. But they don't know. So they are cranking this machine up, trying to get it to maximum power or however close they intend to in this trial run. And the pilot, who is Tom Skerritt, David Drumlin, is up there basically doing color commentary for the news media as well as, I guess it's not NASA, it's what, IMS or something?
The IMC, the International Machine Consortium.
Ah, okay. So he's up there, and he's. I think this is actually well done, also for comedy, where Jodie Foster ends up in the control room, as she is actually part of the team in the control room. And so you're watching kind of ground control.
I think the point is made by her. She goes, you know, I have PR value at the very least, which is probably the only reason I'm here.
Oh, yeah. And it's her discovery. So, yeah, she is going to be there at least as some sort of media representative.
But her absence would be conspicuous.
Exactly. But you have a nice little scene in the control center where you get to know some of the control people. And they actually mock Tom Skerritt as being overly dramatic. Like he says, I feel a vibration, and the vibration doesn't show up in anybody's in mission control. They don't see any signs of any vibration on their equipment. So they're thinking he's basically...
None of the instrumentation indicates that there is any kind of vibration, and so they call him an overcooked ham.
Exactly, yeah. They're thinking he's hamming it up for the cameras. And then, luckily, we have Jodie Foster as part of the team, because without Jodie Foster looking at the monitors, they wouldn't realize that our old buddy from Hanson has made himself part of the crew on the gantry or whatever. And so during this test, he's going to set off a bomb as a religious fundamental terrorist attack, I guess, or protest. So
Nelson strikes again.
Exactly. So faster than you say mbop, they blow up this machine. And Tom Skerritt and $1 trillion down the drain.
Wait a second. Did you just make a Hanson reference?
I did. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't written, by the way. I don't write any of this stuff. This is poor comedy coming out of my head.
Good, because you'd want a refund if you paid somebody for that.
Oh, no. Yeah, I'll just get Drew to come and laugh. It'll be great.
Okay.
So Jake Busey blows up the machine.
And himself.
And himself. And Drumlin. And many, many, many people, theoretically.
Yes, and the whole machine's kaput.
Project is over. Call Chevy Chase. Our Vegas vacation has been canceled. Yeah, no. I'm actually cutting that out, that's for sure. So, Jodie Foster wallows in despair.
And she goes back home, at her current home, which is the very large array in New Mexico. And Kent's there, and they have a warm embrace. And then she goes back to her apartment thing, in which point somebody college dorm room style has set up a television sitting on two chairs with this giant satellite transponder in her little apartment, motel room, whatever it is. And it turns out it's Haddon, a Fremere, who says, guess what? We screw the government as usual, because that's what we do. And there's another machine, surprise! And wants her, if she wants to, go on this new second machine. Because they're still going to send an American, because that's what everybody wants.
And so, flash cut to Hokkaido, Japan.
And then she's on, you know, they take her out on the Harrier jet, and they put her on the boat, and they discuss all the things about, you know, they're going to modify it a little bit so that there's some safety, and they go through, they run through all the equipment with her, which, this is another one of the things I think is kind of a little bit strange and ridiculous. At no point did they consider her as a backup in case something happened to Drumlin. Like she should have been a backup the entire time anyway.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So it just seemed kind of, I mean, I understand for dramatic tension in the movie, but like in real life, of course, we should hope and expect that she would have been the alternate, and she would have been training up until the point that he was actually shoved and buttoned up into the machine. Like she should have expected to go in his stead at any moment.
Oh, you have a point.
I kind of had a hard time. I had a hard time believing that she just didn't already know all of this and that they were having the debate. And again, I know it was part of the story, and so it made for better tension, but that was one of those things I was kind of like, you know, that wouldn't really happen. But again, this improbable science fiction movie or future probable, I guess. But
yeah, I guess they would have still had they would have still had the international team, because you're right. If he would have had a sinus headache, they may have just pulled him and put her in place.
Right, or broke his leg or got the flu or got hit by a car or something.
Exactly. Or if they both had, you know, bad Chinese food, they could pick the third person, because there wouldn't just be two either. There'd probably be three.
Right. So you know, that was the one thing that I found a little bit, like, impractical of, if you're going to have this $1 trillion project, you're not going to get as many people trained as possible just in case.
Well, yeah, so, details.
But again, makes for a better story, probably. Makes for better, you know, makes for a better storyline, because you're able to explain more without it being kind of this drolling, constant, just kind of rote training movie. So she's on the boat, and, you know, they're discussing what's going to happen, and so then she's got some time to reflect, and then, of course, here comes Matthew McConaughey to make up and say, you know, I just didn't want you to go because I didn't want you to go because I want to hump it out with you again. So go, and it'll be 50 years before we see each other again, and, you know, please remember me and come back safe.
Now, when you first saw this movie, did you perhaps think they were going to bone and she was going to end up pregnant in Vegas? Because I did. I'm thinking, she's going to be pregnant. She's going to find out because the Vegans are going to scan her. And she's going to have a tiny McConaughey 25 light years away.
And then there could have been little bongo drums on the beach.
A whole race of bongo playing youth.
Oh.
Anyway, sorry.
Oh, that's like total nightmare fuel.
Yeah, well, I seriously thought it might go that way. But no, they don't help it out again. She's a love him and leave him kind of gal.
Yeah, no, she's very cold and distant in most of this movie. And I think the point is made, I mean, and I think a lot of that's commentary about how she's a cold and removed scientist because, you know, she's had this loss early in life that deeply impacted her. And so her avoidance of the emotion is to run to science.
And that's interesting. I'll have to think a little bit about that.
Because I think as you watch the movie, you know, because she's anytime she starts to get a little bit of emotion, she runs back to the science and she pulls away from the emotion. And she uses the emotion to get her through to the science, but, you know, she's always like her weapon. She was wielding the emotions like, here is your compass back. And then from there she goes, you know, she goes back to the science.
That's true.
So that seems to be kind of a theme. And I don't know if that was intentional kind of commentary or, I mean, I don't know what Sagan, obviously not in the mind of Sagan, so I don't know, but, you know, something to ponder. But so she ends up going, going in the machine, and there's this big, long, sequence of, you know, getting the machine ready and getting it to go and getting her to go. And, then, you know, this great footage of basically finally the payoff where the machine's activated and she goes.
And it's a beautiful scene.
And but also somewhat haunting and creepy because of the, it still kind of creeps me out a little bit. Cause it is some beautiful, beautiful, like, wormhole footage and alternate universe footage. And, you know, they really got some great effects, but like the double, like where you're seeing her thoughts projected beside her in another kind of face of herself.
Yeah. Like, that's kind of a universe. That's kind of a horror movie kind of trope.
I found that very disturbing. And I know it was supposed to be kind of probably dramatic, and, you know, it was kind of be an exposition, if you will, of, you know, because it's basically you're hearing her thoughts through her, but it was just creepy to me. And so it was necessary, but it just was kind of like, it was one of those chills, you know. And so eventually she comes to a point where basically everything stops, and like her chair that she'd been on, which luckily she got out of because her compass broke the chain that was around her neck, given to her from Matthew McConaughey.
Found in the Cracker Jack box.
So she releases herself from her chair, and then through the last wormhole, the vibration is so bad that the chair actually breaks free from the housing and ends up against the wall. The ceiling of the container she's in. And then there's pitch blackness, at which point in the movie theater, I was like, holy shit. Like, she is trapped in this thing in the middle of nowhere forever now, which is like, that's my nightmare. That's like right there. That's my nightmare.
Well, because if you had added the alien monster, this would have been a great time to introduce it. Or some sort of Lovecraftian element to it. This would have been the time.
So I remember in the movie theater thinking, I am not going to be able to sleep at all for weeks now, this is all I'm going to be thinking about, is this horror aspect of this movie, which I didn't see coming. And so then you're pleasantly surprised that she ends up transported onto this beach-like setting, which is clearly a construct, but a very beautiful kind of setting that's completely out of her own mind.
And she knows this because who does she see coming toward her on the beach?
Well, but before you see who's coming to her on the beach, do you understand the where the beach came from?
I do not.
The beach is a very clear reconstruction of Pensacola from the beginning of the movie.
Oh, okay.
She draws the picture of Pensacola.
Oh, okay. I got it. From her ham radio.
Right. So she does a little drawing with the palm trees or whatever they were, the trees on the beach with the sun. Because that beach scene is almost identical.
Huh. I did not get
obviously,
that.
And I didn't get it the first time I saw the movie, but I got it. There's a lot of that in this movie. There's a lot of kind of callbacks that you don't necessarily see the first time, but that was one of those that are like, that's constructed from her mind, as is her father, who isn't really her father. It turns out to be one of the alien entities, and then there's some discussion about... you know, they didn't create the machine. They don't know who did. They found it. But this is how they get other races, other worlds to visit them and start the process of which we don't know, but there's a process. And so they have this brief little chat, and she realizes quickly that it isn't her dad, and she wants to ask questions, but there aren't enough time because the alien basically dismisses her and says, this is the first step, and you've been here, and now you get to go back.
And then,
so nice seeing you.
Exactly.
Smell
so
you later.
It's amazing to her. She even mentions that they should have sent a poet because she cannot describe what she is looking at. And then,
right. And as a scientist, she's ill-equipped to be able to kind of recreate that from an artistic standpoint. She knows from a scientific standpoint, but she can't explain it in scientific values because there's almost nothing scientific about what happened.
Exactly. So then.
So she is then returned to the capsule, which from Earth's perspective went right through the machine and just landed in the bottom of the tank. Done.
Exactly. And she believes she was gone about 18 hours because that's what it felt like to her. That's how much time she spent like going through the wormholes and then talking to the construct and then coming back. But
to everybody on Earth, nothing happened. There was no time lost. She went through the machine top to bottom, and there's no even hint of anything happening.
Exactly. So she is now uncertain, even in her mind, what has happened. Like, was it a dream? Was it some sort of chemical reaction in her brain? Did it actually happen, but she doesn't have any proof of it? Because, of course, the recording equipment fails even before the thing launches.
Right. There's nothing but... you know, they're static on her recording machine, and so did she really have this experience, or was it just a psychotic break? Especially because she's clearly a little high-strung in the movie. She's clearly a little bit of a kind of a loose cannon. She has a history of kind of going off the deep end a little bit. Well, you know, they have the earlier in the movie they talk about how they're making fun of her because she was, you know, listening to washing machines or dishwashers or whatever, staring into the static of television sets. So, you know, there's some question about her sanity. And then, of course, that leads into a hearing about what happened because, of course, now everybody wants to know what the hell their $1 trillion got them other than this crazy scientist.
Exactly. Because now they have no...
Inquisition.
Yeah, there's no data generated from this trip.
Right, and so now there's a reckoning to be had because, you know, all these countries put all this money and they're expecting something and they got basically... sausage. They got nothing.
She is clearly troubled about the whole thing. And, of course, at this point, we have the second change in political characters. James Woods, who is the national security advisor, resigns from his national security post because he wants to head up the investigation into what happened. Whether or not, because he intends to show that the machine was actually a hoax designed by Haddon, because he's a crazy billionaire and can set up these things.
Right. And so she's clearly deeply affected because to her, she's had this huge experience that validates that something else existed greater than what was on this planet, which is what she was after all this time, and she has no way to prove it or articulate it in a way that can convince anybody. And so she's basically a scientist lost.
And she has been she's been the advocate against faith for the entire movie and in her entire life. And now she is left with only being able to say, this is what happened to me. I need you to trust and have faith that what happened to me is what I'm telling you it is.
So she's basically come to McConaughey's dark side, which is, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's an interesting turn of events where, you know, where they have that big, where she has that big exposition about, you know, everybody needs to experience what she has and how James, you know, the James Woods was like, you know, why don't you just admit then if you have to admit that it wasn't, that it's possible it was all constructed and fake, then why don't you just withdraw your testimony? And, you know, where she, you know, she makes her point, like, I can't, because I can't describe how real it was. And, you know, it's something that everybody should experience. And so I have to talk about it because if nothing else, I have to have the gospel. So now she's got the gospel, if you will. And they have that nice little interaction where, you know, they walk out and Matthew McConaughey is asked by the press what he thinks. And he says, well, you know, I believe her because, you know, I'm not going to bite the hand that's going to let me hump it out. So then, you know, cut to the one of the final parts of the movie where you see the National Security Advisor, or the Chief of Staff and the former Security Advisor, the James Woods, who are talking about the video recorder.
And in a very clever, it's a very clever ending. Or actually, let's hold on to that for a second. And
okay,
the next thing you see after Matthew McConaughey maybe you see this part. Maybe I'm skipping the cleverness and going to the very end of the film, where you end up seeing
the very end of the film is her at the array.
Okay, yeah, okay, and that's where she basically is teaching children, and she's basically saying, "Look, you know, we're still listening. We're pretty sure things are out there, and I can't prove it, but it'd be a waste of space."
Right.
Yeah. So that's the nice happy Disney ending of the movie. But
right, which is funded because she got a grant because, as it turns out, the digital video recorder, which is of course the plot twist, that, you know, there was nothing but static on it, so that you can't prove that there was anything there, except for the fact that, as it turns out, the Chief of Staff talks to the James Woods character and basically says, well, it's interesting that there was nothing but static on it, but more interesting that there was 18 hours of it.
And James Woods character said, isn't that interesting? It is interesting.
That is interesting, yeah. Right. So the implication is that it did happen and that, you know, obviously the recorder couldn't have 18 hours of static if it hadn't been running for 18 hours.
Exactly.
If she'd only been gone, you know, if she'd never been gone, then there was no way it could have happened.
Yeah. And in these days where we know for a fact that the NSA is filtering or listening to what we're saying and filtering any information we get, it makes complete sense.
Oh, am I not supposed to be doing the podcast on a cordless phone?
Exactly. Uh-oh. Cordless phone. This is just going on the internets. So, it could be anything.
Oh, they don't watch the internet. We already know that.
Of course. With net neutrality, actually, they'll just basically, Comcast will slow it down such that you won't be able to listen to anything, any of the truth, you know.
It'll just sound like the midget from Twin Peaks.
Yeah, exactly. The truth, you know. We got to listen to talk about the truth because there are secret government conspiracies. If I had a James Adomian type, or maybe it actually is a Dan Van Kirk type, Governor Jesse Ventura impression, this would be the time for it.
so you give this movie a thumbs up.
Yeah, I liked it. I thought it was much faster paced than I thought it was going to be. I mean, when I kind of dreaded going into it because I thought it was going to be slow and sort of schmaltzy, and it had some of those aspects to it. But all the actors are great. I mean, and the direction was great, and it was a nice little story. And it was thoughtful. I mean, on one hand, it's sort of a technical thriller, science fiction story, kind of. And then it's also a political thriller, kind of. But it's also, you know, a philosophical discussion on whether or not, like, religion and science can coexist.
Well, but it also had some pretty, blatant, at least seemingly, to my interpretation, some pretty blatant commentary on how we treat each other as people, because it was a morality story, because it was like, you know, we see that your society has such great beauty, but also great horror, you know, and the only thing that makes us feel better about being alone is each other. So to me, it was this big morality play, if you will. So there was some of that aspect in it too. And I'm not saying it's not, I'm not saying it was a bad thing. I'm just saying it was kind of very heavy handed in that way.
Oh yeah. Well, and the central thought between, you know, she is a scientist. She sees no evidence of a god. So she believes that we have manufactured a god because we need it, you know, for our own mental health. But then she encounters something that makes her believe that she is not alone in the universe, that there are powers greater than her, that she is a very small part of a very big machine that she does not understand. And that in and of itself is like a religious experience.
Right. An epiphany, if you will.
Yeah. But something that she does not understand. You know, it'd, it would be different to say, oh, now we have proof that there's aliens. Well, she doesn't have that. You know, and she doesn't have there's no proof that there's God. But religious people aren't looking for proof. They have faith. You don't need proof if you have faith.
And now she has faith.
Well, yes, because she doesn't have proof, but she has experience or anecdotal evidence, which is still pretty great. And that way she, because, you know, her character all along wanted to believe. She just had to be shown in a way that she could believe. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'd agree with that.
So, yep. So I guess we could use this as a springboard to talk about God and religion and stuff, but...
Well, so before we move on, some interesting things about the movie, at least one interesting thing. The car that Ellie drove in the desert, the little convertible.
Okay.
The hoopty. If you go back and rewatch the movie at some point, when she gets on Haddon's plane and Haddon goes on the retrospective about, you know, where he talks about, you know, here she's born and here's her dad, and it goes through the video slideshow. In the video slideshow, the car is present, so it's her dad's car. The convertible is her dad's car.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
That was kind of, I thought that was a kind of a good point. But interesting of note, the car was a Chevy Caprice convertible. The reason I find this interesting is because Leland Palmer's car in last week's review of Twin Peaks was a Chevy Caprice convertible.
That's funny.
So I'm just like, where are these coincidences?
Believers will find meaning in everything.
Oh my God, just crazy goofy stuff. I just thought, this is weird. I don't, because, what was that?
It was an airplane on my end, if that's what you're hearing.
Okay, just spooky timing. Yeah. No, because I asked Derek last night when we were watching Contact. He was watching it kind of on the periphery, and I said, "Is that a Caprice?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh, okay." And he said, "That's the same as the car from Twin Peaks." And I was like, "It is?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I'm like, "Huh?" So I had to go back and check, and sure enough, they're both Chevy Caprice convertibles. So I don't know. I don't know what the significance is, but it was one of those weird coinkydinks.
I've got a question about Twin Peaks, actually.
Okay.
We talked about the fashions were sort of 50s sort of fashion.
Yeah, throwback.
Yeah. Did Twin Peaks take place in modern time?
Yeah.
Was the motorcycle a modern motorcycle that James was driving, or were there any...
Well, it was as modern as anything.
So it was... Well, I guess the high school was modern, right?
Yeah.
Because it didn't really have, there was no real technology in the movie or the TV show, right? I mean, they're a mill town.
Well, that was part of the thing is it was in such a small town that's why it made things difficult, is because the town was backwards and old.
And sort of timeless, or yeah, old, I guess, backward.
Yeah, it was kind of the town that time forgot.
Yeah. Okay.
Because they would have, you know, you have to send her to Portland because Portland had the facility, and you know there was some of that going on. So, town was largely kind of backwards and old school.
Well, but even the equipment that Kiefer Sutherland used was like old timey equipment, and that I thought was just a David Lynch thing. And it may have well been just a sort of a quirk decision. But now I want to go through, because eventually I'm going to watch Twin Peaks, the show, again. And I want to see how much nod to modern technology is there.
No, there's modern technology, because you have Dale Cooper in his handheld recording device.
Yeah.
And you have, and later on you have recording device, like, I think at one point somebody wears a wire and so, you know, it's not completely backwards.
Yeah. And actually, I'm sorry. Not sorry, but, Chris Isaac's character has, a car phone.
Right.
So, you know, that's not, I mean, it didn't look like the Rockford Files car phone. It looked like a more of a cellular car phone.
Well, of course, again, this, you know, the movie was obviously set at the time the movie was, you know, the TV show was shot, which was, you know, when that would have been time appropriate, when that kind of car phone would have been appropriate. So that would have been, you know, the 90s, really. That's about right.
Because I think the car phone that may still be currently in the 1990 Toyota Avalon doesn't look all that different from what Chris Isaac was using.
Oh, that huge, just giant toaster oven?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that you it's actually too old technology to hook up to current cell phone standards.
Well, and it would just set on fire at this point anyway.
Oh, maybe.
Well, whenever she used it, that thing just turned into a toaster.
Well, that's because she was an old person and she liked things hot. Yeah.
No, I'm talking the cell phone.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I don't remember actually ever using the cell phone.
No, I had to help her program it, and for God's sakes, and the reason it had a hands-free kit is because if you held it in your hand, it would burn you.
That's funny stuff.
So, I mean, it has a complete hands-free kit for the car, and it had, you know, it was hip technology when she bought the car.
Oh, yeah, no, it was, absolutely. It was the first hands-free... The first hands-free...
It took a year to teach her how to use it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But no, that thing was... Now, if you used it for more than, like, 30 seconds, it just, like, started to radiate. I'm sure it probably was actually radiation, but it was just radiate heat like nobody's business.
Oh, that's fun. I wonder if it's still even plugged in.
It's got to be plugged in, because when you start the car, you can hear it. It powers on.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting.
No, it doesn't operate, I'm sure. I mean,
you can't actually even activate it through a cell carrier because it's old technology.
Yeah, but so would it even work on a 911 network?
I don't think so. That'd be a good test, though. I don't think though.
Well, I leave that to you because I wouldn't want to call 911 just willy nilly.
Yeah, I want to do it. Next time I'm around the car, I want to do it. But, I mean, I'll get permission. Well, it won't be a big deal.
I was going to say, I think you're better equipped to get away with that than I would be.
Yeah. No, it's easy enough. It's not a big deal. Just depends on what you say if they answer. That's all.
Well, and that's the thing. Would it even go through?
I don't know. It's an interesting technical question.
Yeah. I'm full of interesting questions.
You're full of something. So, anything else about Contact? I liked the movie. I was, you know, like I said, you called it ahead of time. This is definitely the sorbet that we needed after Twin Peaks.
Oh, God, yes.
Because there wasn't any brutal element of this movie. This movie, it had some thoughtful parts to it, but pretty much everybody had a happy ending.
Well, except for Tom Skerritt, but you really wanted him to have a horrible ending anyway.
Oh, but he died a hero. He would have loved that.
Yeah, well, part of me was hoping he would go through the machine and just be disfigured or something. Like, you know, all of the Fly.
God.
You know, like Vincent Price, the Fly, kind of. Does that make me a bad person?
No, but it makes you hilarious.
Just saying. I was just like, yeah. Just bastard. Just cause constantly. It's like poor Jodie Foster just constantly just gets screwed over. And, you know, it's like if Matthew McConaughey isn't pawing at her, Tom's scared, stealing everything from her. It's like the sister can't catch a break.
I don't want to play, you know, modern warfare games, because I don't want to actually shoot people even virtually. I mean, zombies are fine, but, you know, people are bad. But I don't mind a game where I just throw acid on people. That'd be fine.
See, and that's funny, because I don't like first-person shooter games where I kill people, but zombies or Nazis, which I don't consider people, are fine.
Now, if they invented a game of first-person knee smasher games, you'd be all for it.
Well, probably not knees, because I'm a little sensitive about my knees these days. But maybe if I, you know, I wouldn't mind some disfiguring. But.
Do you remember the video game Psycho about the school shootings? Way back, like an 8-bit game?
No, I don't.
It was, I remember playing it in the computer room at your parents' house, and it was one of those controversial games because you played basically somebody who went, there were different scenes, but you would take your character and just shoot as many people as you could, including police and everything. And at the very end of the game, you got to a school, like a preschool, and all these like preschool students would come out and you would shoot them, but they wouldn't die. And eventually, this is like the end screen of the whole game, you'd be basically attacked and overrun by toddlers. But up until that point, you got points for shooting and killing as many people as you could. Little old ladies, you don't remember any of that.
Huh. Yeah. So it's kind of the ultra early generation Grand Theft Auto, yeah.
Well, even in Grand Theft Auto, I mean, I guess you shoot cops in Grand Theft Auto, but aren't you a cop or something undercover? And the cops that you shoot are bad guys. I mean, are there any of those conceits they still do, or is it just you can do anything you want?
Being Grand Theft Auto?
Yeah, I mean, when you put an M for mature on a game, can you pretty much have, there's no rules as far as morality?
I think that's the case, but I think it's also dependent on what country you release it in, because certain countries have certain restrictions over what games can be released to what populations. Much like Fallout, for instance, was couldn't use, you know, Fat Boy and Little Man in vernacular when they released the games in Asia for obvious sensitivity reasons. The Wolfenstein games, you have to eliminate some of the Nazi references to have it to be able to be played in Germany, which is kind of makes it not something sensible then. But, you know, but so I think largely in America, I think if you slap an M on it, I think that, yes, you can, it gives you much more license to be able to do horrible, horrific, god awful things.
Well, because clearly in Germany, instead of Wolfenstein, it's called Wolfsburg. And all the bad guys are Jews. Or not. Maybe not. Okay. This is what we call Trying Too Hard. Trying Too Hard. Part of the Not in a Creep Parade podcast for the last 15 episodes and hopefully for the next 100 to come.
Wow. And so anecdotally, I just looked up. John Holloman was the CNN reporter who was killed. He was killed. So the movie was 1997. He was actually killed in a car accident in 1998. And so in 1999, NASA dedicated their Launch Complex 39 press site at the Kennedy Space Center in his name.
Oh, that's pretty awesome. Was he a science reporter?
He was just a broadcast journalist, but he was, you know, he'd done some stuff, I guess, for NASA, and probably, I'm not sure why, maybe because of contact, I don't know. But I just remember his death because there was I remember when he died, it was traumatic for his coworkers at CNN because he was killed in a car accident, and it was random, and as most accidents are. There wouldn't be accidents, I suppose. But, like, his screensaver at work was up, and it was basically, you know, John Holloman loves his son or whatever, something like that. And they left it on his screen for a long time just because they couldn't bear to take his computer down. Little things like that, so.
Mm. That is sad. You're bringing us down, man.
I'm sorry.
First, you bring me this movie. You bring me this movie that they glorify Adolf Hitler, and then now we're talking about dead journalists. It's very sad.
Well, we can go back to talking about running over hookers in video games.
I suppose. I don't play. It's funny. The couple times I've gotten into games, it lasts about 6 months, and then I just am. There's some sort of project or another from work that takes me out of it. And then I just have no time. And now that I'm doing the podcast thing, that takes any kind of free time that video games would otherwise occupy.
No, I suffer kind of the same malady with video games. I'll play it for a while, and then I will realize I have other crap I need to get done. And so I'm like, well, I can do laundry, or I can play this game, or I can do laundry, or I can not do laundry. And nah, I better probably have clothes, because, you know, people at work don't like me not having clothes.
Well, and it's... You know, it's one of those things where if you plan a little bit, you can just buy more clothes and have more video game playing time. But then again, it's a resource allocation equation.
Well, that and the DVR has ruined my life forever. Because where before, I would just be like, well, I got this, or I'm going to watch TV. Well, I can't watch TV, so I guess I'm just not going to watch the TV show. Now, I can record everything I can think I'm going to go back and watch, but never have the time to do so. So then I just stew about how much I have on my DVR that I'm never going to be able to watch.
Oh, yeah, I face that. I mean, I think I record The Daily Show, and I also record at midnight. And I only ever watch the first part of The Daily Show, and then I watch the first two segments of At Midnight, and that's it. And then I always probably watch those all in one day, once a week.
Well, and it really kills me. I used to watch religiously Craig Ferguson, but it was too much, and it was just too much to record every week and get through. And on top of everything else, and as much as I like him, I was kind of, after many, many years of watching him, I kind of started to, the thrill was gone. So,
yeah, that's kind
of course now he's quitting anyway. So.
Well, yeah, that's kind of how I feel about Stephen Colbert. It's unless there's something that it's really hilarious, in which case I will encounter it in the wild. I don't really have to sit and watch a show or DVR it and watch it sometime later.
I've never liked him, so.
I think he's brilliant. Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what he does with the late night show.
I don't disagree that he's brilliant, and I think he's funny sometimes, but I just, as a whole, watching it every day, I just couldn't do it. Now, I might watch him when he replaces David Letterman just to see what he does with the show, because I did that with Conan O'Brien. I quite like Conan O'Brien, but
and the Stephen Colbert or Stephen Colbert you're going to get on Late Late Show is different than Stephen Colbert the character.
Very much so.
Yeah, he's a song and dance man.
But hopefully some of that will translate across.
Yep, hopefully he'll be able. You know, that way he'll be able to do interviews not in character. That'll be nice.
You've been listening to Not in a Creepy Way. If you have a rant or rave, please send your email to rants@notincreepyway.com.
Like us on Facebook. Give us 5 stars on iTunes. Leave a comment. Turns out you can leave a 5-star rating and the comment could say your show sucks. And it still makes us happy.